From KYW News Radio, all news and all that matters to you, this is Flashpoint. What's igniting debate online and in your community? I'm KYW Community Affairs reporter Cherry Gregg, and we'll walk you through the big issues of the week that are getting folks hot under the collar. Coming up, as we close out Black History Month, we take a deep dive at how racism impacts kids.
When a child feels excluded, the pain from physical injury and the pain from that feeling of exclusion share the same brain pathways.
Raising Black children in white spaces.
I recognize deeply and painfully what it must feel like to look different.
The authors discuss their journey and goals on this new book. Then he's 15 years old and is CEO of a growing fashion brand.
You know, I just started going out to all businesses and barbershops.
The West Philly kid entrepreneur and the partnership he scored has taken him global. Then they've opened the first menstrual hub in the nation. This is the last weekend of Black History Month, so our focus is on how race and racism impacts children. Our guests are the authors of Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces. Katie D'Angelo and Valerie Harrison met while working at Temple University. They've been friends for years, but when Katie, who's white, adopted a biracial boy, her friendship with Valerie, who is Black, became more than just a series of conversations about differing perspectives. Katie D'Angelo and Valerie Harrison, welcome to Flashpoint.
Thank you, Cherry.
Thank you for having us.
Katie, I want to start with you. What made you say, I think we should write a book on this?
That's the perfect way to open. That's exactly how this conversation between Val and I began. You know, as you know, our 9-year-old son is biracial. My husband, Mike, and I are both white. We adopted him from birth. And, you know, Gabriel is not only a beautiful biracial boy, he happens to be brilliant as well. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about him a little bit today. But we knew early on that we would have to equip our son for an experience far more complex than anything that we had experienced in our lifetime. And it was also evident, you know, that we would need to confront the all too prevalent colorblind and post-racial ideologies that surround us and our family. And we would have to learn to navigate racism and its dehumanizing outcomes before our son would have to. So, you know, even before we knew about Gabe, his aunt Vival and I were in frequent and deep conversations about all that would be necessary to parent a child of a different race. And so knowing Val, you know, this was more than her sowing her wisdom into me. It was the beginning of her sowing wisdom into our future family. So, you know, the whole process turned out to be much bigger than writing a really good book. It's anchored in our relationship, but it was a process of self-discovery and really growing the community that would best support our family. And that clearly included Aunt Vival.
I love that. Aunt Vival, not even yes. Val, but Vival. I love it. And before we go to Val, I just got to ask you, you know, because we did a whole show on transracial adoption and it was viewed in a very controversial way. Why do you think so many people disagree with it, specifically white families adopting Black children? And then what is your response to that?
My capacity to respond to this question has been an important one to Aunt Vival / Dr. Harrison. And as we dove into the research for this book, I began to understand, you know, the National Association of Black Social Workers' position in 1972, advocating for Black children remaining in Black families. And their chief concern was that white families might lack the resources and knowledge to equip a Black child to develop positive racial identity and navigate life in a racist society. And so as the white mother to my Black son, it is very clear to me that white parents must get this simple principle. It is absolutely critical to teach and model positive racial identity in children and develop the tools to effectively cope with issues of race and racism. Black children thrive when their parents, whether their parents are white or Black, do this. However, as we all know, for over 400 years in this country, white people have not been expected to acknowledge racism, let alone consider that it might have an effect on the life of a Black child.
And so your response to that would be?
My response is, we have to do our work. But absolutely, we love this child and we will do anything and work as hard as we need to learn to grow into becoming the best parents to support our child.
Val, when you what made you say, you know what, I'm gonna stand with my friend through this journey?
Yeah, you know, Katie and I had worked together at Temple for almost 20 years, Cherry, before Gabriel was born. And we had developed a friendship, a very close friendship in that context. And like most friendships, we had engaged in a range of discussions, from how to deal with relationships to our value mm-hmm. systems, but also about race and racism. So when Gabriel was born in 2011, as you mentioned, the stakes really grew from two friends engaging in philosophical and academic conversations about race and racism to a white mother trying to equip a Black child to thrive in a white environment, and I being a Black friend and others in her community trying to support her. And so what we were committed to doing is keeping the main thing, or the priority, and that's Gabe's health and welfare. And so we started digging in. It was important to me that Katie understand the pushback from the National Association of Black Social Workers, and that she be able to respond to it, that she understands how racism will continue to operate in Gabe's life in a mm-hmm. way that she has never experienced, but also to understand how critical it is that he have positive racial identity so that he could thrive.
And what do you think the biggest lesson, I mean, because you're Aunt Vival, you're there to kind of do what? What role do you play?
One thing that we have learned over the course of these years, Gabriel is 9 now, is that strong friendships and support require humility. And mm-hmm. so for example, Katie and I agree on most things, but some things we disagree on. And Cherry, you'll appreciate this. We disagree on Gabe's hair. You know, so I grew up in a tradition that little boys get a haircut at a barbershop, right? Shortly after, you know, their first birthday, or maybe a little bit after that. It's like a ritual or a rite of passage. And the barbershop is really more than a place where your hair is groomed. It's a place where stories are shared across generations and where dreams are developed and encouraged. Katie's position was that Gabe should have more freedom in terms of his hair. And so while I'm here to be a support and to be a resource, at the end of the day, she is his mother. And decisions involving him are hers and her husband's. Now, with that being said, she ultimately cut his hair when he was about 7. But I am here to be her biggest cheerleader. My role in my view is to be a cheerleader for her, but to also equip her with knowledge and resources that she may not otherwise have, because her experience has not put her in a position to know or understand those things.
What are some of the things you learn, Katie, about race? Were there aha moments? Was there one that stood
daily,
out?
Daily aha moments. Oh, Aunt Vival is right. I mean, the hair has been a big one. And I mean, sincerely, it's a daily one as well, because, you know, no sooner do you start to learn about just the products that are appropriate and what works best with the very specific texture and type, you know, because one product does not suit every head. It's a constant lesson, you know, every time he gets out of the shower, soaking him in lotion, which thank goodness, I mean, he has a fondness for certain scents. I mean, at 9, he's already very particular about what he likes, what he doesn't like. So it's that, but it's, you know, the other thing, Black church has been everything. And they've just opened their arms to our family and said, come on, let us show you what you've been missing. at your very white Catholic church.
The other thing, if I can weigh in on Aria's aha moments, and we talk about some of the fun things like going to church and haircuts. However, Katie recognized, and we learned from the research, that the brain science tells us that when a child feels excluded, that the pain from physical injury and the pain from that feeling of exclusion share the same brain pathways. So whether a child has been punched in the face, or whether they felt left out, whether they felt like they're lesser than, it causes pain to the body. Katie realized this. She took Gabe to a soccer practice. She signed him up for a soccer team and he was all ready with all the equipment. However, he was the only child of color, either among the players or the parents or the coaches. Yeah. And he did not want to play. Fast forward a month or so later, he goes to a birthday party of a classmate. He really didn't know that many people there, but the classmate was Black, as were all of her family and friends. He immediately jetted as soon as he got in the place and felt a sense of comfort. And so the reality to Katie and to Mike that he actually felt pain in that first instance, they were open to listen to that and then to change course if necessary, and then found a soccer team that was more reflective of his background and his experience.
Had you felt what it was like to be the only before?
No, Val's exactly right. The occasion of taking Gabriel to a soccer field, and mind you, he was 4 years old at the time. Talk about an aha moment. I marched this small child, barely able to fit shin guards. He was so small, right? I marched him onto that field because the child expressed an interest in soccer. So we go onto the field and I know it. I see it instantly that he's the only on that field. But I think, because I've never had this experience before, I think all he cares about is playing soccer and playing with other kids. This won't be a thing. As soon as he got to the field, he folded his arms and would not participate. Wouldn't play. The coach, the kids, and the parents on that field could not have been any more welcoming. He straight up would not participate. It was a couple of days later, we were playing Legos. It was just him and I. And I said to him, I said, "Do you still like soccer?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, then why didn't you play the other day?" And he said, "Because nobody on that field looked like me." He was four. This moment with my four-year-old son was among the first of many now occasions at nine when I recognize deeply and painfully what it must feel like to look different. The other lesson for us was that the boys and the coach and others, they didn't even have to set out to exclude Gabe. Exclusion doesn't need to be practiced in order to be felt. All they had to do was just connect with others that looked and felt most like them. And in white spaces, that is unlikely to be Gabe.
So I want to ask you both, what do you hope someone reads this book? What do you hope they take from it?
The single most important point of the book for me is to show how critical it is for parents of Black children to do everything possible to ensure that their children develop a positive racial identity and that they never feel like there's simply a failed effort at being white. Because what we've learned is that if we don't intentionally work on constructing a positive self-identity for Black children, our culture will construct a negative one around their Blackness for them. We talk a lot about, we've just talked about the brain science and physical pain, but in the book, we talk about stereotype threats that hinder performance. You know, so for Black children, for example, they have been stereotyped as less capable intellectually. And so Black students in a predominantly white school, for example, may feel pressure that their white peers do not. And that depletes their memory. It depletes their energy in a way that they cannot be focused on the task. But what we try to help parents understand, and community members as well, the stereotype can't attach to you if you understand what real Blackness means. So when you understand that Black people led the world in scientific innovation, that ancient Black Egyptians moved and stacked millions of stones to perfectly form the Great Pyramid. Like when you understand that, then AP physics isn't a stretch for you. You don't have to be scared of that. And you can be expected to pursue STEM professions. And so we provide that knowledge in the book for parents and community members to then translate to their children.
This is an opportunity, it seems like, to have conversations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It just seems like it's not just for parents who happen to be raising white parents who are raising Black children. It seems like educators, it seems like a lot of people to get a value from this book.
We talk about the fact that white teachers generally have lower expectations for Black children than do Black teachers. And so as a result of that, Black children who have had Black teachers tend to do well. There's a whole section in there, you'll appreciate this, about HBCUs and the value and benefit of HBCUs and the reasons that they should be considered. And so we think that we have gathered information and resources that we hope provide support and encouragement for parents and community members.
And so, Katie, at last question, got to ask you, what makes you proud to have been a co-author of this book?
Oh, the privilege to be able to do this with Dr. Harrison, Aunt Vival. She's a brilliant educator and scholar all on her own. And so just having that opportunity to be at her wing as she has taught me, and the richness and the beauty and the values that now I'm better equipped and better prepared to instill them into my child. It's the greatest gift.
Katie DeAngelo and Valerie Harrison, check out their book, Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces. Thank you, too, for coming on Flashpoint and talking about this very important issue.
Thank you so much for having us.
Next up, he's a 15-year-old CEO and just scored a partnership with the 76ers.
Like, I always used to go to the games and watch the game from home, but now being a part of the game is amazing.
How a young West Philly entrepreneur took an idea and in 3 years made it global. We'll be right back. This is Flashpoint, and I'm Cherry Gregg. Our newsmaker of the week started his company when he was just 12 years old, and in 3 years, with the help of his mom, he's opened a brick and mortar, got a warehouse, and this week scored a partnership with the Sixers. 15-year-old Trey Brown is president and CEO of Spurgo, and he's here with us. Trey, welcome to Flashpoint.
Hey, thank you so much for the opportunity.
You just got a major partnership with the 76ers. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's like a dream come true. I started Spurgo 3 years ago, and I never thought like I'll be working like with the Sixers. Like, I always used to go to the games and watch the games from home, but now being a part of the game is amazing. And it's just making Spurgo more global and bringing Spurgo to a whole nother platform, bringing Spurgo to millions and millions of eyes. So, you know, it's just amazing. And big shout out to the 76ers.
And so let's explain what this means for your organization. As part of their Buy Black program, 700 businesses applied for this. Two Black-owned businesses won. You were one of them. So you guys get marketing help. You get featured in commercials. You're going to be featured at games. And you have access to all the fans. And they're starting to open things back up. So you're going to be in people's faces every single time they watch the Sixers play.
I was watching the game yesterday, and I seen myself on a game on TNT, on a worldwide game. It's giving more Spurgo more attention all over the world. And that's the goal. Even before the pandemic, I was at like every Sixers game. But now to be a part, and now I'm going to be able to like meet everybody and really become a part of the team, it's a dream come true.
For folks who've never heard of Spurgo, explain what Spurgo is.
I started Spurgo January 15th, 2018. And I started with my birthday money. I had $300 for my birthday, and I spent half of that, you know, on liabilities like video games and music. I was into music at the time. And then I had the other half, and I wanted to invest in something powerful. I wanted to get in fashion just because my mom, she's a seamstress. Fashion is just super essential in our household. You can't come out the house looking a mess, like just everything from your head to the bottom, like everything just got to be right. So I wanted to get into fashion. So I came up with my logo, and I used the other half of my birthday money, $178, and I invested in my first 16 t-shirts. I sold out the first week to family and friends. The next week, you know, I just started going out to all businesses and barbershops all over the city of Philadelphia. And I was just introducing myself in every barbershop, like, hey, my name is Trey Brown. I was 12 at the time. I'm a 12-year-old entrepreneur, and I'm the CEO of Spurgo. And I was just going out, and I wouldn't come into the house, and I wouldn't eat unless everything was sold. So I sold out the first week with 16 t-shirts, used that money that I sold out with and reinvested. Then I got 29 t-shirts, sold out that week. Then we was moving like 35 t-shirts, you know, and then we was able to move on to hoodies. And then we were able to move to our first custom products. Everything that I got right now, I got a full headquarters, a warehouse that comes, that like my warehouse has about like 10,000 products in it. And that comes from, you know, my first 16 t-shirts. So
3 years later, you got a warehouse, a brick and mortar, and now a partnership with the Sixers.
Yep. And another reason why Spurgo collabing with the Sixers is because that is like really what Spurgo about. I came up with the name Spurgo combining the words sports and heroes, and not heroes like talking about superheroes or anything, but like heroes that I look up to all over the world, positive heroes. And I added G-O at the end because Spurgo for the go-getters. It don't matter like what your profession is, as long as you're getting up every single day and chasing your dreams, that's Spurgo.
I love it. And so this positive energy, I mean, you've attracted so many people to your brand. You got superstars rocking Spurgo.
Yes, a lot of great people around the world rocking Spurgo, from Mr. Sean Diddy Combs, Mr. Wallow 267. The list goes on, from the baby, Little Dirt, Little Baby. Like, just everybody is just like rocking Spurgo. Spurgo is like the flyest, like up and coming lifestyle brand right now. It's amazing.
And so it's very chill. You got all different colors. You even sell like flip-flops and slides. You got jackets. You have stuff that is bright if you that kind of person, and also very classic looking like the one you have on. So it has like a range of folks who would be interested in it.
Spurgo unisex. So Spurgo for everybody. When I first made this was actually our Leo sweatshirt. And me and my mom, we were scared to like move forward with this design just because it was simple. At first, we started off like with this logo, and it was bright, and everybody liked it. Everybody liked it that. But we wanted to move into something simple. As soon as we released, you know, these sweatsuits like 2-3 years ago, everybody was just going crazy and neat. And the Leo sweatsuit is actually the sweatsuit that all the celebrities were seeing in. It's like chill, but also like it stands out a lot.
Yeah.
But we just always switch it up. Like sometimes we have products that's going to stand out really bright. And then we also have stuff, you know, that's really like it's fly, but then it's also simple as well. So you could get fly and. Yeah.
So what are some of the things the highlights in these 3 years? If you were to say two things that you will never forget that you think were pivotal moments so far.
Best moments. It's been a lot of moments, but the top two moments that I know I will never forget. Number one, my billboard in Times Square. I got a billboard in Times Square, and that's still running to this day. You know, so that's amazing. And then also kicking it with Mr. Sean Diddy Combs, in his house, like, you know, just talking to him and being able to network with him and just learning from him and learning. He was teaching me like how he moved. I always wanted to be mentored by him, and now I am mentored by him. So that's just amazing. That's some of the top two greatest moments, but it's been a lot of other moments as well. Retired my mom at 13 years old. I got a commercial with CNN and Invesco. Opened up my first headquarters in 2020 during the pandemic. It's been a lot of great moments.
Yeah, and now you got the Sixers.
Now I got the Sixers.
Which is a whole nother avenue. What's your vision for Spurgo?
My vision for Spurgo is for Spurgo to be that positive, like the go-to positive brand. So whenever you want to have a positive day, like, you know, like I want to have a great day, so I'm going to rock Spurgo today. So that's what I really want Spurgo to be. And also my vision is for Spurgo to become like a global brand. Like we got our headquarters in Philadelphia, you know, but we starting to like branch off as well, you know, so it's just getting better. Like Spurgo Billionaire on Instagram, it's like growing like 1,000 followers every day. You know, so that just shows you,
wow,
like, every day, like, we're growing.
Positive vibes to you. So tell people where you're at brick and mortar. Where can they come by and see some of your merchandise?
So to shop Spurgo in person, you could go to 2943 West Master Street, Philadelphia, PA, 19121. And if you want to shop Spurgo online, if you're not in the Philadelphia area, you could go to spurgo.com. So SPERGO.com.
Yeah, check them out. Sky's the limit for you, Trey.
Yes, sky's the limit.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you so much. I'm truly grateful.
Next up, the Philadelphia woman who's opened the first menstrual hub in the nation.
It is a safe space around everything related to menstrual care and menstrual wellness.
Her fight against period poverty and why she just might win. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Flashpoint. I'm Cherry Gregg. Be sure to subscribe to the Flashpoint podcast by downloading the radio.com app, Apple Podcasts app, or other platforms. All you have to do is search Flashpoint. Now, we here at KYW, we are all about community, and a Philadelphia-based nonprofit is putting a stop to period poverty by opening the nation's first menstrual hub. Here to talk about the spot period is our Patriot Home Care Changemaker, founder of No More Secrets, Lynette Medley.
Welcome back to Flashpoint, Lynette. And first of all, congratulations. In recent days, you had the grand opening of the spot period. For people who don't understand what a menstrual hub is, explain.
So the spot period, and spot stands for Safety Programming for Optimal Transformation. It is a safe space around everything related to menstrual care and menstrual wellness. It's a drop-in center to be able to get feminine hygiene products, for people to donate, but also for people to have access to toilets and running water and safety from our communities that somehow aren't the most safe space for a lot of marginalized women. So it's going to be an epicenter for information sharing, but everything about uterine care and menstrual wellness and health.
Wow. And this is a big deal, y'all. I just want to say, because I met Lynette a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C. at a Black History Month event, and she was talking about ending period poverty, educating me on the spot. And now you have a hub. And tell us, for people who just really don't understand what period poverty is, like I was ignorant to it, and you just have a wonderful way of explaining it and making a subject that used to be very uncomfortable very comfortable to talk about.
Definitely. So period poverty is the inability to access menstrual products and also access waste management services. And we don't normally think about period poverty, but I really, you know, articulate it in a way that says, when you think of poverty, you always think about housing insecurities and food insecurities. So these same populations cannot buy menstrual products or feminine hygiene products. So they will use unhealthy methods like, you know, socks or gloves or newspapers or rags or anything that they can find to meet their monthly cycles, in addition to engaging in high risk behaviors from, you know, inappropriate sexual relationships or just stealing, which can actually, you know, cause them to end up in prison systems just because of lack of access to a pad or tampon.
Do you feel like the time is now, that the conversation becoming easier for you?
I think the time is now, just because people are more open to talk about issues that have to do with the female reproductive system, just, you know, women's rights in general. But I think everybody's just taking note of things that have gone unnoticed and overlooked in our community, especially around marginalized populations. And, you know, this is a big issue in Black and brown communities.
Yeah. And so you've been able to forge partnerships nationally with companies, with organizations. Talk about that a bit.
So we are an official partner of Diva Cares International. So they gave us $5,000 to be able to create the Breonna Taylor safe space room that we have for our vulnerable populations. And it's just a relaxation room with a TV, with futons, and just sit back, you know, and enjoy and be, you know, safe. And we also have toiletries in there. And they also are giving us 2 months supply of Diva Cups. We're just glad to have that partnership. And our other partnership is with the PAD Project in partnership with Elle by Procter & Gamble. They donated $4,500 just so we can get menstrual products. And our other partnership right now is with period.org, which is going to offer some first period kits.
Yeah. And I just want to point out that people don't realize menstrual products, feminine hygiene products are expensive. And if you have a daughter, you have yourself, you could be spending $50 to $100 plus a month just on products that are basic necessities.
Definitely.
And you guys have been working to change laws that would make it easier for people who are, you know, low income to get access to these products.
And I think that's the main issue. One of the reasons we wanted to also open a hub was to really push politicians and legislation to realize this is a real issue in our community. Like, we hear it's happening, but we're not really talking about it. But now it's in your face. This needs to be adjusted. And also, we already have communities that live in food deserts, right? So we don't have access to what the best supermarkets or the best, you know, places to buy things. So even with menstrual products, they have to go out of their neighborhood to be able to get them. They don't have the big name stores to have them at a regular price. They're going to their corner poppy store where they're charging $18 to $20 for one pack. So that's another disadvantage that our community has that no one is talking about.
I love that you're raising these issues. How can people support you in the work that you do?
Well, of course, we have an ongoing GoFundMe right now. We were trying to get to 120. Again, we have to pay rent. We have to pay utilities. We have to get products. And also we have a computer center in here. You know, we're giving other resources to our community. But the big thing I need is a van. We're still doing deliveries because, again, not everybody can leave their community. Or we're dropping off large supplies to, you know, facilities.
Where can people check out your website?
NoMoreSecretsMBS.org.
I want to say congratulations to you, Lynette Medley. No More Secrets. You can check them out and donate and help them get a van.
Yes.
Make delivery. That's it for Flashpoint. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Flashpoint Show. And since we always wrap it up with a quote, here's one from political activist and philosopher Angela Davis. In a racist society, it is not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist. This show was produced by Ariane Fulcher and me, your host, Cherry Gregg. Flashpoint is sponsored by the Gift of Life Donor Program. Organ donors save lives. Until next week, thanks for listening.